maker's tools in the manner how he took it in pieces and put it together again. When he came home, he first made himself tools, and then made a clock which went as true as any in the town. I suppose such strength of genius as this has scarcely been known in Europe before. Another proof of it was this. 30 years ago, while I was shaving, he was whittling a top of a stick. I asked, "What are you doing?" And he answered, "I am taking your face, which I intend to engrave on a copper plate." Accordingly, without any instruction, he first made himself tools and then engraved the plate. The second picture which he engraved was that which was prefixed in the notes upon the New Testament. Such another instance, I suppose, not all England or perhaps Europe can produce. For several months past, he had far deeper communion with God than ever he had had in his life, and for some days he had been frequently saying, "I am so happy that I scarcely know how to live. I enjoy such fellowship with God as I thought could not be had on this side of heaven." And having now finished his course of 52 years, after a long conflict with pain, sickness, and poverty, he gloriously rested from his labors and entered into the joy of his Lord. Sunday the 13th. After a day of much labor at my usual time, 9:30, I lay down to rest. I told my servants, "I must rise at 3, the Norwich coach setting out at 4. Hearing one of them knock, though sooner than I expected, I rose and dressed myself, but afterward looking at my watch, I found it was but 10:30. While I was considering what to do, I heard a confused sound of many voices below, and looking out at the window toward the yard, I saw it was as light as day. Meantime, many large flakes of fire were continually flying about the house, all the upper part of which was built of wood, which was nearly as dry as tinder. A large deal yard, at a very small distance from us, was all in a light fire, from which the northwest wind drove the flames directly upon the foundry, and there was no possibility of help, for no water could be found. Perceiving I could be of no use, I took my diary and my papers and retired to a friend's house. I had no fear of committing the matter into God's hands, and knowing he would do whatever was best. Immediately the wind turned about from northwest to southeast, and our pump supplied the engines with abundance of water, so that in little more than 2 hours all the danger was over. Wesley in the Fens, Tuesday the 22nd. I took a solemn and affectionate leave of the society at Norwich. About 12 we took coach. About 8, Wednesday the 23rd, Mr. Dancer met me with a chaise and carried me to Ely. Oh, what want of common sense! Water covered the high road for 1.5 miles. I asked, "How must foot people come to the town?" "Why, they must wade through." About 2, I preached in a house well filled with plain, loving people. I then took a walk to the cathedral, one of the most beautiful I have seen. The western tower is exceedingly grand and the nave of an amazing height. Hence we went through a fruitful and pleasant country, though surrounded with fens, to Sutton. Here many people had lately been stirred up. They had prepared a large barn. At 6 o'clock it was well filled, and it seemed as if God sent a message to every soul. Friday the 25th, I set out between 8 and 9 in a one-horse chaise, the wind being high and cold enough. Much snow lay on the ground, and much fell as we crept along over the fen banks. Honest Mr. Chubbs would needs walk and lead the horse through water and mud up to his mid-leg, smiling and saying, "We fen men do not mind a little dirt." When we had gone about 4 miles, the road would not admit of a chaise. So I borrowed a horse and rode forward, but not far, for all the grounds were under water. Here, therefore, I procured a boat, fully twice as large as a kneading trough. I was at one end and a boy at the other, who paddled me safe to Erith. There Miss L. waited for me with another chaise, which brought me to St. Ives. No Methodist, I was told, had preached in this town, so I thought it high time to begin. About one I preached to a very well-dressed and yet well-behaved congregation. Thence my new friend, how long will she be such, carried me to God Manchester, near Huntington. A large barn was ready in which Mr. Berridge and Mr. Venn used to preach. And though the weather was still severe, it was well filled with deeply attentive people. Saturday the 26th, I set out early and in the evening reached London. 1775, Wednesday, February 22nd. I had an opportunity of seeing Mr. Gordon's curious garden at Mile End, the like of which I suppose is hardly to be found in England, if in Europe. One thing in particular I learned here, the real nature of the tea tree. I was informed, one, that the green and the bohea are of quite different species. Two, that the bohea is much tenderer than the green. Three, that the green is an evergreen and bears not only in the open air, but in the frost perfectly well. Four, that the herb of Paraguay likewise bears the frost and is a species of tea. Five, and I observed that they are all species of bay or laurel. The leaf of green tea is both of the color, shape, and size of a bay leaf. That of bohea is smaller, softer, and of a darker color. So is the herb of Paraguay, which is of a dirty green and no larger than our common red sage. Wesley's coach upset. Sunday, August 6th. At 1 I proclaimed the glorious gospel to the usual congregation at Erstow, and in the evening at Leeds. Then, judging it needful to pay a short visit to our brethren at London, I took the stagecoach with 5 of my friends about 8 o'clock. Before 9, a gentleman in a single-horse chaise struck his wheel against one of ours. Instantly, the weight of the men at top overset the coach. Otherwise, 10 times the shock would not have moved it. But neither the coachman nor the men at top nor any within were hurt at all. On Tuesday in the afternoon, we were met at Hatfield by many of our friends who conducted us safe to London. Monday, October 30th, and the following days I visited the little societies in the neighborhood of London. Saturday, November 11, I made some additions to the calm address to our American colonies. Need anyone ask from what motive this was written? Let him look around. England is in a flame of malice and rage against the king, and almost all that are in authority under him. I labor to put out this flame. Ought not every true patriot to do the same? If hireling writers on either side judge of me by themselves, that I cannot help. Sunday the 12th. I was desired to preach in Bethnal Green Church, a charity sermon for the widows and orphans of the soldiers that were killed in America. Knowing how many would seek occasion of offense, I wrote down my sermon. I dined with Sir John Hawkins and 3 other gentlemen that are in commission for the peace, and was agreeably surprised at a very serious conversation kept up during the whole time I stayed. Wesley and the American War. Monday the 27th, I set out for Norwich. That evening, I preached at Colchester. Tuesday at Norwich, Wednesday at Yarmouth. About this time, I published the following letter in Lloyd's Evening Post. Sir, I have been seriously asked, from what motive did you publish your calm address to the American colonies? I seriously answer, not to get money. Had that been my motive, I should have swelled it into a shilling pamphlet and have entered it at Stationer's Hill. Not to get preferment for myself or my brother's children. I am a little too old to gape after it for myself, and if my brother or I sought it for them, we have only to show them to the world. Not to please any man living high or low. I know mankind too well. I know they that love you for political service love you less than their dinner, and they that hate you worse than the devil. Least of all did I write with a view to inflame any, just the contrary. I contributed my mite toward putting out the flame with rages all over the land. This I have more opportunity of observing than any other man in England. I see with pain to what a height this already rises in every part of the nation. And I see many pouring oil into the flame by crying out how unjustly, how cruelly the king is using the poor Americans who are only contending for their liberty and for their legal privileges. Now there is no possible way to put out this flame or hinder its rising higher and higher, but to show that the Americans are not used either cruelly or unjustly, that they are not injured at all, seeing they are not contending for liberty. This they had, even in its full extent, both civil and religious, neither for any legal privileges, for they enjoy all that their charters grant. But what they contend for is the illegal privilege of being exempt from parliamentary taxation, a privilege this which no charter ever gave to any American colony yet, which no charter can give unless it be confirmed both by king, lords, and commons, which, in fact, our colonies never had, which they never claimed till the present reign, and probably they would not have claimed it now had they not been incited thereto by letters from England. One of these was read, according to the desire of the writer, not only at the Continental Congress, but likewise in many congregations throughout the combined provinces. It advised them to seize upon all the king's officers and exhorted them, stand valiantly only for 6 months, and in that time there will be such commotions in England that you may have your own terms. This being the real state of the question, without any coloring or aggravation, what impartial man can either blame the king or commend the Americans? With this view to quench the fire by laying the blame where it was due, the calm address was written. Sir, I am your humble servant, John Wesley. Preaching from the Stocks, 1776, January 1. About 1,800 of us met together in London in order to renew our covenant with God, and it was, as usual, a very solemn opportunity. Sunday the 14th, as I was going to West Street Chapel, one of the chaise springs suddenly snapped asunder, but the horses instantly stopping, I stepped out without the least inconvenience. At all my vacant hours in this and the following week, I endeavored to finish the concise history of England. I am sensible it must give offense, as in many parts I am quite singular, particularly with regard to those injured characters, Richard III and Mary Queen of Scots. But I must speak as I think, although I am still waiting for and willing to receive better information. Tuesday, April 30. In the evening I preached in a kind of square at Colne to a multitude of people, all drinking in the word. I scarcely ever saw a congregation wherein men, women, and children stood in such a posture, and this in the town wherein 30 years ago no Methodist could show his head. The first that preached here was John Jayne, who was innocently riding through the town when the zealous mob pulled him off his horse and put him in the stocks. He seized the opportunity and vehemently exhorted them to flee from the wrath to come. Wednesday, May 1st. I set out early in the next afternoon, reached Whitehaven, and my chaise horses were no worse for traveling near 110 miles in 2 days. In traveling through Berkshire, Oxfordshire, Bristol, Gloucestershire, Worcestershire, Warwickshire, Staffordshire, Cheshire, Lancashire, Yorkshire, Westmoreland, and Cumberland, I diligently made 2 inquiries. The first was concerning the increase or decrease of the people, the second concerning the increase or decrease of trade. As to the latter, it is, within these last 2 years, amazingly increased, in several branches in such a manner as has not been known in the memory of man. Such is the fruit of the entire civil and religious liberty which all England now enjoys. And as to the former, not only in every city and large town, but in every village and hamlet, there is no decrease, but a very large and swift increase. One sign of this is the swarms of little children which we see in every place. Which, then, shall we most admire, the ignorance or confidence of those that affirm population decreases in England? I doubt not, but it increases fully as fast as in any province of North America. a very extraordinary genius. Monday the 6th. After preaching at Cockermouth and Wigton, I went on to Carlisle and preached to a very serious congregation. Here I saw a very extraordinary genius, a man blind from 4 years of age, who could wind worsted, weave flowered plush on an engine and loom of his own making, who wove his own name in plush and made his own clothes and his own tools of every sort. Some years ago, being shut up in the organ loft at church, he felt every part of it and afterward made an organ for himself, which judges say is an exceedingly good one. He then taught himself to play upon it psalm tunes, anthems, voluntaries, or anything which he heard. I heard him play several tunes with great accuracy and a complex voluntary. I suppose all Europe can hardly produce such another instance. His name is Joseph Strong, but what he is the better for all this if he is still without God in the world. Friday the 17th, I reached Aberdeen in good time. Saturday the 18th, I read over Dr. Johnson's Tour to the Western Isles. It is a very curious book, written with admirable sense and, I think, great fidelity, although in some respects he is thought to bear hard on the nation, which I am satisfied he never intended. Monday the 20th. I preached about 11 at Old Meldrum, but could not reach Banff till nearly 7 in the evening. I went directly to the parade and proclaimed to a listening multitude the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. All behaved well but a few gentry, whom I rebuked openly, and they stood corrected. Neat and elegant Banff. Banff is one of the neatest and most elegant towns that I have seen in Scotland. It is pleasantly situated on the side of a hill, sloping from the sea, though close to it. It is sufficiently sheltered from the sharpest winds. The streets are straight and broad. I believe it may be esteemed the fifth, if not the fourth, town in the kingdom. The county quite from Banff to Keith is the best peopled of any I have seen in Scotland. This is chiefly, if not entirely, owing to the late Earl of Findlater. He was indefatigable in doing good, took pains to procure industrious men from all parts, and to provide such little settlements for them as enabled them to live with comfort. About noon I preached at the New Mills, 9 miles from Banff, to a large congregation of plain, simple people. As we rode in the afternoon, the heat overcame me, so that I was weary and faint before we came to Keith. But I no sooner stood up in the marketplace than I forgot my weariness. Such were the seriousness and attention of the whole congregation, though as numerous as that at Banff. Mr. Gordon, the minister of the parish, invited me to supper and told me his kirk was at my service. A little society is formed here already and is in a fair way of increasing, but they were just now in danger of losing their preaching house, the owner being determined to sell it. I saw but one way to secure it for them, which was to buy it myself. So, who would have thought it? I bought an estate consisting of 2 houses, a yard, a garden, with 3 acres of good land. But he told me flat, "Sir, I will take no less for it than £16 10 shillings, to be paid part now, part at Michaelmas, and the residue next May." A town of beggars. Here Mr. Gordon showed me a great curiosity. Near the top of the opposite hill a new town is built, containing, I suppose, 100 houses, which is a town of beggars. This, he informed me, was the professed regular occupation of all the inhabitants. Early in spring they all go out and spread themselves over the kingdom, and in autumn they return and do what is requisite for their wives and children.